So, good evening, everybody. Looks like we're at the movies here. We're not. So, I'd like to welcome Clifford Sarin, who's professor at UC Davis, long-term meditator and connected to Spirit Rock, has done extensive research on meditators through mindfulness practice, and he'll tell you a lot more about his own research and his work at UC Davis. But mostly just want to welcome you, Clifford, and thank you so much for sharing your depth of wisdom and experience in the mindfulness research field. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark. I've never given a talk inside a retreat that I was not sitting in, which was a whole other experience. I'm very moved to be here today. One of the constant situations that I notice in presentations about mindfulness in education or psychotherapy or the workplace or law or fitness, and it goes on. Now we'll have fashion in a moment. Is a kind of, the notion of embodiment is kind of left at the door. And there's a lot of interest in fast and quick and efficient. And there really isn't, in my mind, the kind of commitment that you demonstrate being in this room. So I want to reflect to you that that is a very moving thing for me. I was in Joseph's first class at Naropa in 1974. And so sort of the notion of a PowerPoint in a retreat about research on meditation to meditators who do not actually need to know the data, because you are the data, really has a kind of odd circularity and gallows humor, if you will, since I have nothing to share with you that you don't know. Nonetheless, we're here, and I have a remote control. So, scientific investigation of contemplative practice. What can we capture, and what does the world make of it? So this is actually original artwork that was done by the daughter of one of the participants in the Shamatha Project. Maybe some of you have heard of this endless research project I direct. We're now 10 years in. I'll be here in 10 years and say this 20-year research project, we're 20 years in. So this is a not so far, it's not really a caricature. This is kind of what we did. But scientific investigation of meditation has gotten very popular. And the choice of model and cheekbones notwithstanding. I don't know how many have read this article, but it really doesn't leave you with a very deep appreciation of the path. Maybe you can hear in the distance in Central Park the plapping of a basketball being dribbled. That was sort of the image, sensory awareness, but self-awareness, not so much. And maybe you saw this in the Huffington Post just a few weeks ago. The mighty powers of meditation. We don't have the resolution for you to see that this says increases gray matter, which we don't know what that means, where. Are these blood vessels, cells, neurons, glia? What would happen if somebody wanted to shop and you let them loose in Walmart versus Costco versus Bloomingdale's? You might find changes in gray matter. The controls necessary to determine what's causing the change in gray matter don't exist. And if you read the fine print in one of these large, even the longitudinal study by Britta Hotzel that showed gray matter changes in 8 weeks, there's a small paragraph in the discussion. There was no relation between the amount of meditation practice and gray matter change. But it's the mighty power of meditation. We could go on, but we better make a killing on Wall Street. This was in Bloomberg Pursuits just 2 weeks ago, interposed with ads for watches and private jets. If you want to win on Wall Street, meditate. I'm in that article. Why? Yes, I thought I was doing the right thing. 2.5 hours of conversation about ethics and its removal resulted in not a word of that, though there is a line, an act of revolutionary courage by the author, that Joan Halifax gets to say, maybe you should consider ethics. Why us? Because Wall Street brokers want to know if how they can improve their visual perception to see what's on the trading screens faster than the next guy. Brain hacking, it's called. Now, there's a wonderful article in the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, just published a couple days ago. Meditation and Mindfulness for the Petty Bourgeoisie. And the author is wonderful because he sort of says, I just finished a 6-month Vipassana retreat. Maybe some of you guys know him. He's a mindfulness Vipassana teacher in Hawaii. And he said, you know, I'm really glad that the science is beginning to become very confused because at least now we can get back to the business at hand. Here is a remarkable meditation hall, and absent this room was, you know, I thought this was the most beautiful meditation hall in the world, but I found this one, which is quite remarkable. This is Dharma Drum Buddhist College in New Taipei City, Taiwan, last November. A Chan Buddhist contemplative center, the largest Buddhist institution in all of Taiwan. We were treated to their aspiration, their future vision for their training. They want to improve their compassion training by fMRI scanning all the students. And they're not just talking. They actually have put together an entire plan, a multi-million-dollar research project, which thankfully, after our modest moral outrage, is on hold. Because they'd never heard of two words which are not in common parlance, reverse inference. You cannot know what you're experiencing by looking at your brain activity. And you certainly can't know how compassionate or mindful you may be. But Buddhism is not as experienced with modernity as the Catholic Church. And so there's a kind of susceptibility to the inexorable pull of modernity. Why am I telling you all this? At some level, the research findings, if you're going to become a researcher and deal with the complexity of the issues, that's one thing. But I'm hoping to create, as Cy Sims used to say in New York, an educated consumer. And perhaps you've seen the new fashion institution, which is a store in LA. The best dressed monk, attire for the mindful man. Consignment. If you go to Barnes & Noble in Corte Madera down the road and you get a copy of Mindful magazine with Arianna Huffington in a pose on the cover, open the page and there's a full two-page spread, Best Dressed Monk. Now, there's a whole other way of looking at all of this sort of stuff that we're engaged in here. And it's actually a very august and century-old theoretical view. This is an illustration from the New York Times last year. Relax, you'll be more productive. So it turns out that if you come to a laboratory and I give you a very taxing memory experiment, you have to remember a four-digit number that was presented three numbers ago. It's called an N-back task. It's infuriating. But it's a very good measure of short-term working memory, a certain kind of cognitive capacity related to attention. If you do this test and you take a walk in the woods and you come back to the lab, or you take a walk downtown and you come back, after the walk, if you walk in the city, you do a little better, and this is a practice effect. But if you walked in nature, you do fantastically better. So this is called attention restoration theory. We all know from experience that we have limited attentional resources, but they can be restored. A lot of what you're doing here is restoring attentional resources. If you interact with an environment that is inherently fascinating, with stimuli that modestly engage your attention, you can actually replenish your limited attention resources. Natural environments are such things. This is what we evolve to see. So, you know, you're in a beautiful place. You could look outside. But I, you know, prepared the talk in case it was dark. The requirement for directed attention when you walk outside is really minimal. You're just kind of going where what interests you takes you. So after interaction with natural environments, you're better able to perform tasks that are taxing. Now consider this. This is how most of us spend a lot of time. In an urban environment, you constantly have to yank your attention from things that are clamoring for it, especially if you're in front of a web browser, and you now have a war. It's kind of like an arms race for your attention. Will the ads become more interesting than the content you're looking for? And you're also having to attend to things that don't kill you. unlike natural environments, these environments contain huge stimulation that you have to actively disattend to or attend to save your life. And this consumes attentional resources. So they do not have a chance to be replenished. So this is a psychological theory that actually speaks directly to the restorative effects of natural environments. So, this is fine. You know this. Here, let's think outside the box. Consider this experiment. You're coming into this room, and we have a 5x5x5 cube over in that corner. And half of you are going to come in just a few at a time. Some are going to sit in the box, and some are going to sit in this glorious space. Then I'm going to give you a creativity test. Like if I say, worm measuring and recording, what's a word that links all those? Tapeworm. Recording tape, measuring tape. You're more likely to come up with the word if you're sitting outside the box than inside the box. So architecture and natural environments have profound effects on the quality of your mind before you, you know, just out of the box, so to speak. What would these results be if the participants had closed your eyes? Because I'm going to argue that sitting here, the world within, is a natural environment. That is simply to tell you that when one considers results from meditation, is that the environment? Is that the architecture? And those questions are just the beginning for a consideration of the incredible importance of context. There is much discussion of secularization of Buddhist practice. But there's also discussion of the soteriological intent of Buddhist practitioners. That word was new to me before I started hanging out with my Buddhist scholar friends. The salvation interest, the possibility of fruition of the path. Buddhist worldview. In our project, could we have taken people off the street and asked them to sit for 3 months? Or did they want to, following the training that I'll describe with Alan Wallace, attain their understanding of shamatha? These things interact in terms of research questions. So we have two questions we could focus on. One is, what do people do when they meditate? Anybody here care to answer that? The variability within individuals from sitting to sitting makes this already within a person impossible to answer. The variability person to person compounds that impossibility. What research paper says, we have no idea what people are doing, so we'll tell you what we tell them. And then ask, but we don't know if they did what we tell them. So it's possible to consider that there might be a program investigating the phenomenology, the relations of variability, but in our hands we think this is too large a question to tackle straight off. So we go, we're doing all this. Ah, I don't want to forget the Tuchus effect. if you stay in this room for several hours, your visual cortex changes to optimize your visual perception of the spatial frequency characteristics of the slats in the ceiling and the Buddhist statues and the windows. It's literally been demonstrated that dendritic spines disappear and reappear to optimize your perceptual sensitivity. Your brain is like a gland molding itself to the exact local circumstances of your embodied existence, your situated existence. So you're constantly changing. Last time I came here, I had 4 days of seeing a strange rectangle in my visual field, even when I was walking outside. And then it hit me. That was my 24-inch Dell monitor. You know, we have screensavers so that we don't burn the phosphors on our screen, but we ignore the essential phosphors we burn into our brain by our repeated activity. So the Tuchis effect, independent of what you might be doing in terms of practicing Bodhidharma, Buddhadharma, being inspired by the teachers, the radical behavioral change of your hours per day in this room is having consequences on your whole body and brain organization. Natural environments, architecture, Tuchis effect. You don't have to take notes, but you may take note. But there's another question. What do people do differently because they've meditated? What do they do that has been transformative to some aspect of their behavior, their relationships, their perceptions, whatever it is that you might measure, when they're not formally sitting? Here we can look at what we call trait changes, and we can use the methods of science. We can have experimental settings. We have lots of experience measuring sustained attention, perceptual sensitivity, emotional responsivity. We can look at values and worldview changes. We can consider the developmental trajectory of embodiment of the practice by measuring you repeatedly in an ongoing fashion. And we can integrate your phenomenological experience, how teachers might view you, the second person, how others close to you might view you, and what we might measure. And of course, these things are recursive. So, as part of becoming an educated consumer about meditation research, there are many, many design issues. One of them is whether you're just going to do a study of taking a group of individuals, and those are, say, community controls, and then a group of, say, long-term practitioners or people who have undergone some meditative training, and you're just going to compare those groups. Generally speaking, there will be psychological differences between those groups that might actually be what's causing there to be differences between the groups in your study. There are many durations of intervention, and some of the scientific research actually is immediate carryover effects. There is a study by Esther Papes and Larry Barcelou with smokers, giving them a mindful instruction immediately before seeing pictures of cigarettes and smoking paraphernalia. And if you are told to pay attention to the sensations evoked by the image, you have a decrease in activation of your reward system. It appears like your craving has been modulated by mindfulness. This word, the M word, if it means retention, not just of the object, but why you should pay attention to whether you're retaining the object because of your commitment to everything on this path? Is it reduced to pay attention to sensations? Control groups. We can take a matched control group. I can take split you down the middle, so to speak, and randomize you to a condition where you're going to meditate, and you guys are going to go for a walk in the woods for a week, and you'll come back for meals. Or there's something really important, and that's an active, that actually encodes it. We could have kept you guys at home, but perhaps if you did go to the woods but didn't sit, and you guys sat, and then you come to the lab, we might not be able to tell a whole lot of difference. And in fact, a few of the studies with mindfulness-based stress reduction that have used a very carefully controlled active control called the Health Enrichment Program. This is work by Donna McCoon, Richie Davidson's group, Melissa Rosenkrantz, and others. There are very hugely overlapping results for a training in a group situation with the same amount of physical activity, the same amount of homework, and the same amount of social support as in MBSR trainings. So the differences are subtle. They may be very important, but it may be even more important to actually understand that the measures that we're using scientifically are not capturing where the body is buried. I don't think I can emphasize that point enough. So on the one side, you can say, there's really just social support. Mindfulness doesn't carry much variance. But then, what is the measure? We have questionnaires. We have making little inflammation marks. In fact, in one experiment, if you get a scratch test, you get a little scratch on your skin and you put pepper in the scratch, the mindfulness group shows a little less of a what's called neurogenic flare. You know, if you put pepper in a wound, you increase the inflammation. But if you suffer about the inflammation, that accentuates the inflammation. And in the MBSR group, there was a little less of that. But in terms of large stressful interventions, the hormonal changes longitudinally for response to very strict judges asking you to perform on command, no difference. So, how to move forward? I've kind of taken you into a morass. Are there ways out? There may be many ways out. Why am I showing you a weather map? My colleagues Antoine Lutz, Amishi Jha, and John Dunn and I for the last 3 years have been thinking about what would be a way of looking at the qualities of mind that you are actively cultivating here and portraying them in a kind of experimentally tractable heuristic. Because if you just talk to psychologists about what the agenda is with your mind and the cushion, it's really hard to get traction. Because no questionnaire quite gets at it. No experimental method quite gets at it. So, you know, I have 20 minutes to give you a 40-minute talk. So I'm going to present this for your edification and see what you think. And whether I get to some data from our project or not, we'll see. Consider a space. We can make this cube have dimensions. One dimension, sort of, object orientation. This is going to become a phenomenological state space model of the mind in which you can think about the effects of contemplative practice and other mind states. The degree to which you are on the object, the degree to which you're focused. Second dimension, de-reification. The degree to which you see thoughts as objects and do not identify with them. The third dimension, meta-awareness. This is a complex concept, and I can't tell you that it's truly orthogonal, but graphically it would be very complicated if it wasn't orthogonal. So we'll say it's orthogonal. This is the sense of, within the context of focus, having an awareness of context, of the periphery, allowing for the possibility of monitoring your quality of awareness on the object. The arising of reflexive awareness. Now you have a cube, and we think that this captures three primary dimensions that are consciously cultivated in practice. So now, within each of the spaces here, we can consider four subsidiary dimensions. Aperture. Are you focused on the very one pointed, one small spot, or you have a panoramic sense? Clarity. You may be focused, but you may be dull. Your perception may not be vivid. Dullness, laxity, vividness. How stable is your mind state? What's the probability at the next moment in time you'll be in the same place? And if a distraction occurs, how far will the movement in this space take you before you return to where you were? And finally, effort. How effortful is it to be in that location? So we can put things in here, like addictive craving. The addictive craving has low effort, it has high clarity, and it's narrow focus. We can put focused attention meditation, if you're a novice, high effort, medium clarity, small aperture. Expert, mind stays where you put it. Very low effort. We can put open monitoring, high meta-awareness, very low object orientation, low effort. We have mind wandering, no effort for mind wandering. Not stable, and may have high clarity because you're highly identified. So you have very low de-reification. So you can actually think about bopping around in this. There may be, and it's for work yet to come, regions of this space where you should not go. People sometimes have adverse experiences in retreat. If you have so much meta-awareness that you become focused on the sort of noise in the background, your sense of self in a conventional, small s way, may become very unstable. So we have to think about and actually engage with multiple teachers what the manifold should look like where there's sort of nice, healthy practice. And if somebody's moving in a direction of instability, maybe it can become a heuristic for that. Just a thinking tool, not the way it is. We came up with this, you know? And then a graphic artist made that. The experiment that I'll talk to you a little bit about involves focused attention for 3 months full-time retreat. I'm going to introduce you to Francisco Varela, the intellectual father of the dialogue between cognitive science, Buddhist philosophy, and practice. And we had a fortune in the old days of being with Alan Wallace and working with monks in the foothills of the Himalayas on Baksu Mountain outside McLeod Ganj, where the Dalai Lama lives. And while it was a cross-culturally fraught, overly romantic, anthropologically challenged project, it was deeply inspiring. And we got to hang out with some folks who changed our lives very easily. This man spoke about working with his mind like a cabinet maker, just pulling out the different tools that he used when he was feeling turbulent, depressed, overexcited, despairing, elated. Utter neutrality with respect to mind state descriptions. He had been tortured by the Chinese. This was a hearing aid. He was the only one who talked to us about his practice. We asked this monk the difference between sadness and compassion. And he said, simultaneously, you need to find the conditions of suffering unbearable, yet you must love them, the conditions that gave rise to the suffering, as a mother might love her child, because only then would you gain the penetrating understanding of causes and conditions to motivate your solution space. I have the MP3 from 1992 on that computer. So I said, you don't need the research. So now I'll tell you a little about the research. Can, you know, because we're scientists, so we do research. Can focused attention help train attention? Can focused attention meditation actually help train your focused attention? Can training in loving kindness and compassion improve emotion regulation? Are improvements in attention related to psychological function? And what are the physiological changes that accompany these effects? So in 2007, we had 60 people. We formed a committee. I don't think too many sets of scientists have created two weightless controlled 3-month retreats. We formed an admissions committee. And we matched these groups to either be in one retreat or another retreat. So we had a waiting list design. So we had the first retreat happening at Shambhala Mountain Center in the spring of 2007. And we flew the randomly assigned non-meditating group to the retreat center 3 times for 3 6-day trips, where they lived at the same altitude, ate the same food, and were tested in the same way as the folks who were meditating full-time. Then those folks themselves went into a 3-month retreat 3 months after the end of the first one. So that means that we have a match control group across time, and we have an extensive baseline for these same individuals in blue when they get tested during retreat. And we are doing follow-up testing at 5 months, 15 months, and now we're doing interviews, cognitive tasks, and questionnaires 6 years after this training. Training emphasis, shamatha practice, relaxation, stability of attention, perceptual clarity. The techniques, about 6 hours a day, mindfulness of breathing, settling the mind in its natural state, and awareness of awareness, and practice of the 4 measurables, the Brahma Viharas, about 45 minutes a day. What do we expect? Well, you should improve your ability to focus if you keep bringing your mind back to an object thousands and thousands of times. We hope you will have an increased ability to withhold inappropriate responses. Increased ability to engage with suffering when it arises in self and others. An increase in pro-social tendencies. We had many different laboratory tasks. We implemented 15 separate computer-based experiments. It was kind of the space lab of meditation studies. Not going to go into all of the things, but we're looking at brain activity, autonomic measures, how well you perform. We're looking at biochemical markers, and we do thematic analysis of interviews, qualitative data. So this is the lodge. This was Alan in the second retreat. We built 2 side-by-side labs. We had a whole bunch of hardware. And we find many psychological improvements. We combined improvements in all of these constructs and decreases in all of these. And when you put them all together, the control group doesn't change, and the retreat group, if you set them equal at the beginning, significantly improves and is significantly improved 5 months later. The control group, when it goes into its own retreat, looks identical. So that's an independent replication. But you know, folks had a lot of time to give us the answers they wanted on a questionnaire for a project that they're investing all this personal capital in coming to. So what else relates to these qualities, psychological qualities? So this is a pair of chromosomes. This is the telomere, the cap at the end of the chromosome. And as you age, the telomeres get shorter. When your cells divide, the telomere doesn't get copied along with the rest of your DNA. So your longevity is actually limited by your telomere length. However, there's a remarkable enzyme called telomerase. So as your cells divide, the telomere is getting shorter. And then telomerase is an enzyme that can build that length back, reversing cellular aging. So what we find is the retreat group, this is work that was published by Tanya Jacobs, who is a postdoc fellow and collaborating with folks at UCSF, Liz Blackburn and Alyssa Eppel. The retreat group at the end of 3 months had 30% more of this enzyme that can repair the shortening of your chromosomes. That's kind of amazing. We know that mothers of kids with autism or catastrophic illness, they have less. Meditators in 3 month retreat have more. But psychological changes were related. The control group, this is a graph of change and a sense of purpose in life. And telomerase at the end of 3 months, no relationship. In the retreat group, the more you experienced an increase in your sense of purpose in life, the higher your telomerase. I need to tell you that I didn't say that your telomerase changed and it was at one level at the beginning and higher than it had been at the end, because we did not measure it at the beginning. So this is a graph of change in psychology predicting telomerase at the end. We're replicating this study this year by measuring, we took blood at the 1 month retreats a year ago in March here. Built a blood lab in my house down in Corte Madera, and I bothered people in the Monday night class for about 9 months before we had enough comparison folks. So stay tuned. We'll see if this replicates. What about attention? It can be really boring, even more boring than I'm being now, by a task where you see a long line and then the line's only on the screen for a tenth of a second. You can tell that's a short line, but we make it really, really, really hard, because for 15 minutes, we measure your perceptual threshold, and every time you can see the short line compared to the long line, we make the short line a little longer till you can't tell if it's a long line or a short line. And then we say, okay, now we'll make it a tiny bit shorter. And if you can see it too easily, we'll make it a tiny bit longer. And that is how we establish your psychophysical perceptual threshold. So here you go, having just done that, and for half an hour, without a break, you're going to have to press the button either every time you see a short line, and short lines only come every 10% of the time. They're very infrequent. And what we find is you find that after training, people, after 16 minutes, they have no fall-off in this what's called vigilance decrement. This is kind of an up-leveling of the same techniques that were used to demonstrate, you know, radar operators can't be trusted for more than a few minutes behind a screen because their vigilance decreases. But the reason why they got better is because their visual perception improved, and that replicated in the second retreat. And that's why the reporter called me for Bloomberg News for making a killing on Wall Street. Response inhibition improves. Now take the same task, and this time, 90% of the time, you push a button when it's a long line. When you think you see a short line, you withhold. This, you know, it's like Listerine, this task. It's a brilliant, boring, infuriating task because you actually can tell, oh, I knew that it was a short line, but I pressed anyway. And if you're really attentive, as you guys are, about your own internal process, you'll actually be able to learn a whole lot. In fact, some of our participants are telling us that we should, you know, we ship them laptops, and they're saying you should market this for a mindfulness exercise. So this is before training, both groups combined, and then after training, and they have really improved sustained response inhibition. But this actually, to the extent you get better on this task, it predicts your psychological functioning. We've replicated this here at Spirit Rock. This is 1 month retreatants before and after training. So this is the first presentation of data collected from yogis in this room meditating in this room. This is a control group, shows no change. We also found that mind wandering decreased in our project. What about emotion? So it's 8:28. You want to take questions? I should wrap it up. So I'll wrap it up. We're interested in changes in the type of emotion that happen. One way to do that is to look at people's facial expression in response to difficult-to-watch stimuli. And I'm not going to give you very graphic stimuli here because you're on retreat. But the tendency for people is to push away, to have a kind of rejection response to seeing acute suffering. Either it could be anger or contempt or disgust. And we expect instead an increase of sadness. So we look at a person while they're looking at a movie. This is work led off by Erica Rosenberg. We've finally just submitted this paper after years of work. These are not, I took some of the most graphic out. So here is a father carrying an injured child. Here is a soldier. These are images from the Iraq War, speaking remorsefully about the suffering he witnessed. We code facial expressions, every one of the 46 muscle groups of the face using Paul Ekman's facial action coding system, every single frame of video to create a Talmudic database of facial expression. We want to be ecumenical in our metaphors. This is the data for 12 seconds of emotional expressions. You can go through all of this, and you know what? You can tell quantitatively that she's showing grief. We find before the retreat, trainee and control groups don't differ in how likely they are to show sadness. After the retreat, the meditators were significantly more likely to show sadness. That was our prediction. In terms of rejection emotions, there was no difference in the amount of rejection emotions at the beginning. We showed them a really devastating clip from the movie Crash, which I will not describe. After the retreat, trainees, the yogis, were equally likely to show rejection emotions, but if they showed rejection emotions, they showed significantly fewer. Which means you might get the signal, it's disgust, oh, and then you kind of work with more spaciousness in the mind. So, decreased pushing away sadness. We showed people a storyboard and asked them to tell us when their emotions changed. We look at what people reported when they showed sadness. And after the retreat, the yogis significantly reported more sympathy, but not more sadness. So we think that the sadness expression actually reflects the growth of empathic concern. Well, okay. So I'm just going to not go through this, just to tell you, we've interviewed people in the second retreat, and now we're trying to use graph theoretic and network analytic methods with Baljinder Sadra in Australia and Jen Pokorny, who's a postdoc in the lab, to try to look at how your current perspective or approach on life and priorities and everyday activities changes longitudinally over the course of a retreat. Because then we can relate personal meaning to these kind of quantitative results. This is a huge work with an enormous village of collaborating scientists and students. I'm incredibly grateful to be able to speak a bit of their collective work. And there are a lot of funders I'm also deeply indebted to. That's it. Thank you. Time, a few minutes? Yes. Some questions? Yeah?
Pretty loud voice. The longitudinal project you're showing
it's going to be recorded.
I wish I had known that before I raised my hand.
I think it's a
testing?
Yeah.
Yes?
You're on.
Okay. The longitudinal project that you were talking about, I think it was the Shamatha project. I noticed that the retreat is 3 months and you start collecting data at 5 months and then at various...
No, we collected data from people before they were assigned to retreat. They didn't know which retreat they'd be in, and we got baseline measures. Then, because if I assign, it's like have a kid get into college, they haven't gone yet, their life changes as soon as they're assigned to college. So we had to verify that the groups did not differ before they were separated into the two retreats. Those 5 months, 15 months, and 6 years data, those are follow-up data.
Right.
We collected data at the beginning of the retreat, at the middle, and at the end.
Yes.
And we have daily diaries.
Thank you. I understood that. My question was more about the follow-up data.
Oh, okay.
And how are you controlling for the multiple different activities, continued practice and so on, that could actually be influencing your findings?
You're not controlling. You ask them for their meditation experience, the retreats they've done. Some of our participants actually went into continuous retreat for 6 years. They built earth ships on Prajna Mountain in Santa Fe, and they practiced in the caves they built for years. And We ship them laptops and have them do questionnaires just like everybody else. So it becomes, the follow-up is not a controlled study. It's a naturalistic study. And we, you know, I'd love to do this on 300 people, but the money isn't there and the time isn't there. So we can only try to do analytically analyses, since we know how much people were meditating or what sort of things they did. And we have the description of what they've done in the interim by the interviews we have.
Thank you.
So I apologize, my brain is a little fuzzy, and I was wondering if you would just take a moment to summarize the findings from your study.
So we've got 6 papers published so far, and I should let you know I have a little 16-minute TEDx talk that you can listen to. And most of this material is online in the form of other talks. There's a hour and 15-minute talk from the Dalai Lama Center for Ethics at Vancouver on an education heart-mind last year. A lot of this material was presented. So I talked about finding improved psychological change on many different constructs, all added together. More well-being, less anxiety and depression, less neuroticism, more openness to new experience. That replicated for both retreats. I talked about how telomerase at the end of 3 months was greater in the retreat group, but it was predicated upon a change in the sense of purpose in life. And what I didn't tell you is that it was also inversely related to neuroticism, less neuroticism, more telomerase. And it was also related to a sense of environmental mastery, your own sort of locus of control. Then I told you that people got better in sustained vigilance, sustained attention, but that being better in sustained attention was actually due to having better visual perception. Because if your job is to detect a kind of unusual event and your visual vision gets better, then it's easier to detect the event. We're doing an experiment with brain recordings taken during these tasks. And hopefully in a year or two, I'll be able to say, you know what? When you have to watch for a thing every 2 seconds, the meditators learn to lay back during the 1 second. They don't have to do anything. And then you have this kind of pulsatile. Sustained attention is not like isometric forcing. It's maybe just more like breathing. And so this attention restoration process is actually a skill that can be embodied. And we may be able to tell that by looking at ongoing EEG measures. Then I said response inhibition improves, and it actually is predicting how well you do on this adaptive psychological functioning, replicated here. And then I talked about emotional responsivity, less pushing away of difficult to watch human suffering, more sadness, fewer instances of rejection emotions. And then I showed you hand-waving figure of, you know, changes in qualitative data that we're trying to quantify. That's the summary.
You know, it definitely seems like you have some ethical questions related to how people are using your data. And I guess I'm just curious if you have any wise words for us as facilitators or hopeful facilitators, you know, inviting people into this practice, and just the ethical implications of that.
Just go with what you know and why you do it. I think, I mean, when this touched my life, there was no data, you know? And I remember sitting at IMS, watching the thermostat on the wall while being able to simultaneously track people putting away their dishes. And I, as a neuroscience type, said, very interesting. Maybe we can do a study. But it wasn't like hearing about that got me to meditate. So I think the instrumentalization of the oversimplification of the research probably isn't going to convince someone, but your authenticity would carry the day. So I think that's what I think.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask you a question that's not quite on your path, which is why it's all the more interesting for me to ask you. I'm a somatically trained psychotherapist, and I wonder if you ever ran across Ron Kurtz in the Hakomi Method in Colorado, but also Mark is trained in somatic experiencing. And so what I'd like to ask you, I mean, there was an article in the New York Times a few weeks ago called PTSD, a Revolutionary Approach, and it was an article about Bessel van der Kolk and his work, like Pat Ogden, with helping trauma with more body-based somatic mindfulness.
You know, I'm an old hippie. I was Ralph 20 times. I studied Tai Chi. You wouldn't know it to look at me, but, you know, there is a... I did yoga. A benefactor treated me to a week at the Golden Door in San Diego, and I got deep massage 7 days in a row and classes. I'm a follower of the body.
Yes.
I think it's deeply, deeply connected. We're embodied. And it's so connected that it wouldn't make sense that it would be otherwise. So it's not so... I mean, we did this through an accident of history. I roomed with Francisco Varela because Richie Davidson couldn't go to the Mind and Life conference in 1990. I'm in Dharamsala. Alan wants to do the shamatha thing. We go to meet these monks. It's incredibly inspiring. It's cross-culturally totally fraught. And I didn't give you the beginning of the talk that says, these guys could have always been extraordinary, and that's why they're in retreat. So we got to do it longitudinally, and you can't exactly drag the whole lab up to the mountain, to their huts. So I'm deeply think that there's a huge path there.
And now there's a blogger that's been very popular and well-reputed, who's a Rolfer, and a Feldenkrais practitioner named Todd Hargrove, who's recently...
I know of him.
Yeah.
I'm on an NIH grant that is going to try to look at the effects of Tai Chi versus cognitive training versus exercise. There's people really understand that this is Peter Wayne from Harvard was just teaching Tai Chi at the Summer Institute of Mind and Life last week in New York. Not a problem.
Okay, great, thanks.
Is there like an ice cream cone? Yes, would you mind repeating the comment and the origin of the comment regarding the understanding between sadness and compassion?
So the origin was a monk who was living on Baksu Mountain in 1992 when we were doing this project to see whether we could use some of the nascent tools of cognitive neuroscience to see what the effects of Tibetan mental training was. So we kind of did a field project, and we had Alan Wallace as a Tibetan translator who had been a monk there for 14 years. So he was a kind of entree to the world of these individuals, and he could speak the language with a Lhasa accent. And they knew him. So we came asking, what is the relationship between sadness and compassion? And he said there are separate mind streams, but sadness could catalyze the arising of compassion. But this relationship has this overlap where you have to find the conditions of suffering simultaneously unbearable. But you have to penetrate with love to understand the conditions that gave rise to the suffering. And he went so far as to say, a quality of love like the love a mother has for their child. So you can't say how terrible, you can't wring your hands while your heart breaks. That was my understanding. Our lives changed after hanging out with him for a couple of hours. Thank you for that question. It's always good to repeat that.
Thank you very much for your talk. I was just wondering if you're willing and able to share that PowerPoint if emailed.
So the PowerPoint is on most of the slides on there, is on YouTube. I don't share the PowerPoints because there are enough caveats required to go along with the slides that I really, as part of not going beyond, the papers are published. For the most part, we have 6 publications. Those are all available on our website. And the PowerPoint is available with my commentary on YouTube.
Great. Thank you.
If you go to HeartMind2013, DalaiLamaCenter.org, that's one. And you can, the TEDx, you just do TEDx Sarin, and then you get it.
Hi. Thank you so much for your talk. I was excited to see you mention Berman and Berman's research on attention restoration theory.
Yeah.
And I'm an ecotherapist, so I'm really interested in the power of the natural world to heal. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, I know it's a little off topic, but hopefully not too far off topic, whether that's also a research interest of yours, and whether you're aware of any other high quality research that's been done by anyone other than Berman and Berman.
There is a good deal of research on architecture and hospital environments, and there is a woman whose name I'm blanking on, Esther, forget her last name. She gave a talk at the Being Human event in San Francisco, not this one, but the second one last year, not this March. And she is a specialist in that, and she's written a book about it. I think it's called Healing Spaces. And you can always go on PubMed and, you know, dig around, Google Scholar. We live in this wonderful world of academic excess. That's about it. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you so much, Clifford, for both the depth of your practice, which is really evident, and both honoring of the depth of the practice and really trying to, both the beautiful research that you're doing that's trying to cut through some of the morass of the hype around the mindfulness data, and just sharing your perspective, which is really refreshing. So thank you. So it's time now for walking practice. So if the bell ringer can ring the bell at 9:10, we'll come in for a short sitting to close the night. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.